this talk will not end with a yes or no answer to that question, I'm afraid. It's one of these typical headlines that's meant to lure you in. But I will try. So roughly 40 years of trying to go beyond the standard model in various ways hasn't yet led to any clear success. And I think the mood of physicists who work on that is getting to be a bit frustrated. So maybe we should try a different game instead. So for example, there are probably lots of other games we should try instead, but for example, we could try to understand why the standard model is the way it is. In other words, instead of complaining about how ugly and complicated it is, maybe we should take this as a wonderful, complicated clue that nature has provided us and really try to see why it is what it is. Now, this also seems extremely hard to do. I'm not really saying that this is much easier than what people have been trying to do, but at least it's a different game, and so you have more chance of succeeding if you play several games at once. So in the process, of course, we may be forced to go beyond the standard model. The usual way particle physics succeeds, as historically, is they find a pattern that fits the data, and then they predict one or two extra particles as well, and then they look at higher energies and they find those particles, and then they feel confirmed. We're in a situation where that strategy seems to have petered out. And so in fact, you know, we might not find any more particles in our lifetime beyond the standard model particles. So I would just like to leave it completely open as to what the result of trying to understand the standard model is. But I want to emphasize that this general game plan of trying to understand the standard model is not mainly about creating highly symmetrical theories like grand unified theories or string theory that have less and less connection to the world the more and more beautiful and symmetrical they are. What we actually see is at least close to the standard model, and so it's nice to try to wrap our minds around the project of trying to understand the standard model or something very close to that. I'm saying all this stuff not because it's new to all of you. In fact, the people in this series of talks seem, at least a bunch of you seem to be focused on exactly this goal, but I thought I'd just try to articulate it because it's quite different from the general goal of particle physics of trying to round out the standard model and make it more and more symmetrical by going to grand unified theories and superstring theory and so on. So there are lots of things about the standard model that would be great to understand, and in very rough order of difficulty, who knows how difficult they are actually, but in apparent order of difficulty. So the standard model gauge group, its representation on one generation of fermions. So those are mathematically interesting structures that we could try to understand better. The Lorentz group action on fermions as well. In particular, what I'm referring to is the fact that we have very different left and right-handed fermions. The fact that there are three generations is harder. It's getting harder and harder as we go up here. The Higgs boson and its couplings, which give 22 of the, I guess, 25 dimensionless constants in the standard model. That seems incredibly difficult to understand. That is the to explain those couplings as anything other than random numbers. And then the gauge field coupling constants, which are three dimensionless constants. So of course, the project of trying to understand the fine structure constant has exercised people for a long time, and seems that in general, people have given up on that as a hopeless task. So indeed, we may decide that any one of these things or all of these things are hopeless to understand. They may just be the way things are and there's nothing more to say about it. But if we don't try to understand them, then of course we never will. So I'd say nothing ventured, nothing gained, we'd better give it a shot. Of course, a lot of people have been doing that. This is not a new project, but this is, I claim, a slightly different project than the project of grand unified theories and such. So in my talks, I'm giving two talks, and both my talks, I'm only going to focus on a very limited portion of this evidence. I'm only going to talk about the standard model gauge group and its representation on one generation of fermions. That may seem like very slim pickings for work on physics. And that's true, but I still think there's quite a lot to say about it. So I will try to talk about various attempts to make these seem like mathematically natural entities. So to get out of the mindset where you say that this is like a random mess and that a grand unified theory should step in and clean it up. So a lot of this, in fact, maybe I could almost say all of what I'm going to talk about is a review, and I feel almost embarrassed talking about it because some people in the audience, some of the other speakers in this series know all this stuff already, but I'll try to present things in a nice way that maybe will trigger some thoughts. I'm really just trying to trigger people's new ideas here. And because I'm a mathematician, one thing I want to do is focus very much on Lie groups rather than on Lie algebras. Of course, Lie algebras are a wonderfully convenient way of working with Lie groups, but different Lie groups can have the same Lie algebra. For example, the rotation group and its double cover, the spin group, have the same Lie algebra. And that means that working with a Lie algebra leaves out some information, and that's can be extremely important and interesting information. Indeed, the whole discovery of spin 1/2 particles is the discovery that the true symmetry group involved in describing spin is not the rotation group, but its double cover. And there are a lot of these subtleties around in what I'll be talking about. I also want to emphasize the mathematician's attitude towards groups. So one way to deal with groups and group representations is just to say, well, a group representation is just a wonderful thing to have around because it demanding that operators be invariant under some group restricts the possibilities, and so it gives you a handle on things. In other words, there, you're not really trying to understand why the group is what it is, you just work with it. But mathematicians like to think of every group as the symmetry group of some mathematical structure. And sometimes you find yourself with a group, and the most famous example is the monster group, the largest of the sporadic finite simple groups. You find yourself with a group, often from doing some classification theorem, and then you don't know what it's the symmetry group of. And so then you struggle to find what that group is the symmetry group of. And when you find that out, you typically learn a lot of new stuff. So the whole project of monstrous moonshine, for example, is to a large extent the project of finding what that group, the monster, is the symmetry group of. So we may be in a slightly similar situation with the standard model gauge group. It's easy enough to write it down, but to find what mathematical structure, what natural mathematical structure has that symmetry group, is an interesting and non-obvious question. The more natural you try to make the structure, the harder it gets, right? And so I'm hoping that that may shed a little bit of light on the standard model. So for an expository account of some of the review material I'll be going through here, there's a paper that I wrote with John Huerta called The Algebra of Grand Unified Theories that was intended to be an introduction to this math for mathematicians. So it involves a lot of explaining basic physics, but we discovered a couple of interesting things en route. Okay, so people often say that the standard model gauge group is U1 times SU2 times SU3. We'll see that that's a little bit inaccurate, or at least not the best thing to say. So this group has a center. The center of U1 is obviously U1. The center of SU2 is Z mod 2, because it consists of the square roots of 1 times the identity matrix. So those give you matrices whose determinant is 1. And similarly, the center of SU3 is Z mod 3, consisting of the cube roots of the of 1 times the identity matrix. And of course, that's a general pattern for any SUN, that its center is Z mod n. So we have this center. And the reason why the center of a group is so important, one of the reasons, and there are lots of reasons, is that if you have any irreducible representation of the group, then any element in the center has to act simply as multiplication by a phase. I guess I'm talking about a unitary representation here. The same phase on every vector in that representation. So we get these phases from central elements acting on irreducible representations. So now the center of times SU2 times SU3 contains a really important element, which is important not by virtue of pure mathematics, but by virtue of physics, that it's this element that acts giving you the phase 1 on all known particles. So it acts trivially on all known particles. And so here zeta is e to the 2 pi I over 6. So it's a certain sixth root of unity. And the element zeta comma zeta cubed comma zeta squared is in the center of the group U1 times SU2 times SU3. So remember, zeta is a sixth root of unity. So, well, it's in U1, so it's already inevitably in the center. But zeta cubed will be a square root of unity. So that's in the center of SU2. And I mean negative 1. Zeta cubed is negative 1. And negative 1 times the identity matrix is in the center of SU2. And then zeta squared will be a cube root of unity, which when you multiply it by the identity matrix, which I'm doing implicitly here, is in the center of SU3. So this particular guy, as I said, acts trivially on all known particles. And if you say, what does it mean that it acts trivially on all known particles? One way to phrase it is that it imposes certain requirements on the hypercharges of particles. The hypercharges determine the action of U1. And so this relates U1 to the actions of SU2, which is connected to isospin, and SU3, which is connected to color. So if you go through the different kinds of fermions in the standard model, the requirement that Y acts trivially imposes certain requirements on the hypercharge, which I've just listed in this table. So for example, left-handed quarks have to have a hypercharge that's an even integer plus a third for this to be the case. And then if you go out and look, you see that left-handed quarks have a hypercharge of 1/3 and so on. So these rather curious looking hypercharge assignments that we see in nature are to some extent, although you can see here not completely, pinned down by this requirement which you could decide to impose, that this element acts trivially on all known particles. In any event, this element acts trivially on all known particles. So I'm going to take that seriously and think of it as not a coincidence and work with it. So it generates a subgroup which has 6 elements because zeta is a sixth root of unity. And this Z mod 6 subgroup acts trivially on all known particles. So we can mod out the standard model gauge group by that particular Z mod 6 subgroup and get a group which I'll perhaps somewhat tendentiously call the true gauge group of the standard model. Of course, if tomorrow we found some particle that violated the rule that this element acts trivially on it, then I'd have to say, well, it wasn't really the true gauge group of the standard model after all. But that's just what I'm going to call it to distinguish it from the group that everyone talks about all the time. I should point out that while I was thinking about this, that I realized that there are 12 different normal subgroups of U1 times SU2 times SU3, which are all isomorphic to Z mod 6. So there are lots of Z mod 6s running around that you might mod out by. And you have to get the right one here to be doing the right, to be doing the one that shows up in physics. Actually, that's not exactly true. There are, I believe, at least two subgroups with six elements, two Z-mod six subgroups that when you mod out, you get the true gauge group of the standard model. Basically, because you can replace zeta with zeta inverse and get an equally good one. But anyway, in some work, you get a Z-mod six subgroup, and then you have to worry about whether it's the right one. So these are the kind of subtleties that I'm talking about that you face up to when you're dealing with Lie groups rather than the Lie algebras. These subtleties, at first, they just seem annoying because they involve extra complexity, but we're so desperate for evidence that I think we should embrace all these sort of annoying subtleties and take them seriously. Okay, so there's a nicer description of the true gauge group of the standard model, which is really fundamental to grand unified theories, which arises from the fact that there's a homomorphism from U1 times SU2 times SU3 into SU5. It makes this group into a subgroup of SU5. And so what you do is you take your 2x2 matrix G and your 3x3 matrix H and make a block diagonal matrix out of them. And that, of course, will be an SU5. But then you can stick your phase alpha in U1 into this in a nice way where you put A cubed in the 2x2 block and A to the negative 2 in the 3x3 block, so that if you work out the determinant of the matrix with an A cubed and an A to the negative 2 down the diagonal, you get 1 as well. So you can hide the phase, so to speak, or tuck the phase into the SU5 in that way. And of course that will commute with everything else, so it's all hunky-dory, it's fine. But the interesting thing is that the kernel of this homomorphism phi is exactly the Z mod six subgroup that acts trivially on all known particles. You can work out this matrix is the identity, and you will see that you get just what I had on the previous slide, that particular element that I mentioned and its powers. So the kernel is just what we're interested in, just right. And the image is also very nice. So the image is just all the matrices in SU5 that are of this block diagonal form with a 2x2 block and a 3x3 block. So I like to call this group S of U2 times U3, because what we're doing is we're taking any matrix in U2 and any matrix in U3 and making a block diagonal matrix out of them, but then we're imposing the requirement that the big 5x5 matrix has determinant 1. So the S comes afterwards, right? So the individual blocks don't need to have determinant 1 because, and that's what this alpha does for you, is it gives you matrices where the individual blocks don't have determinant 1, but the overall matrix does. So since we know that the kernel of this homomorphism is the Z mod 6 group that we're interested in, and the image is exactly this group S of U2 times U3, that proves that S of U2 times U3 is U1 times SU2 times SU3 modulo that particular Z mod 6 subgroup. So it's what I'm calling the true gauge group of the standard model. So this is a more attractive way to think about the true gauge group of the standard model. And it lets you do some other nice stuff. In particular, it lets you understand the representation of the standard model gauge group on the fermions. So all the fermions and all the anti-fermions in one generation, but also including a right-handed neutrino and its antiparticle. So henceforth, I will act as if those exist. All of them fit into the representation of S of U2 times U3 on the exterior algebra of C5. So that's the direct sum of all the exterior powers of C5. Or I guess if you're a physicist, you might be more likely to say the Grassmann algebra of C5, since Grossman was the one who invented this stuff. So obviously, once you know what this stuff means, it's obvious that the linear transformations of C5 act on lambda of C5. So in particular, SU5 has a representation on lambda C5 given in that way, and so does its subgroup S of U2 times U3. And this is that's a very nice packaging of all the complicated particle representations that you find among the fermions into what looks like a mathematically very beautiful package. And it's nice in various ways. For example, the left-handed particles, left-handed fermions and anti-fermions live in the even grades, lambda 0 and lambda 2 and lambda 4, and the right-handed ones live in the odd grades. And there's a Hodge star operator on lambda of C5, as there tends to be for exterior algebras. And that maps the left-handed fermions to right-handed fermions and vice versa. I didn't completely check, but I think this is basically the CP operation on particles.
I see Cole has a question.
Cole, yes, sorry.
Yep. Just a quick question, if you don't mind. Sure. So if you were to build a model with this, would you keep both of the parts, both the fermion and the anti-fermion part, or would you throw one out and then how exactly would you navigate that?
Well, I leave that up to your skillful hands, but to me, the whole exterior algebra seems like a more mathematically natural object than just one of these halves. For example, the even part is actually an algebra. That is, you can multiply these things in the even part. The odd part isn't even an algebra. The whole thing is an algebra, which is interesting. And so I wouldn't want to throw them out unless there's some reason why I did. See all these particles, so I'm quite happy with it.
I would agree, except that you can, as far as I understand, you can throw out half of them and then build a Lagrangian with only half. You would also, of course, need to include spin, but you would just, so this way the particles and the antiparticles are linearly independent from each other, as opposed to just being related by a conjugation.
Well, they're linearly independent from each other. They're in this setup here. There's this operation that maps one to the other, but I mean, they're different basis vectors. So all of our favorite particles are like the, you know, right-handed quark of a certain color. They're all in different basis vectors of this 32-dimensional vector space. I'm sure you know that. I'm just being mathematical fuss budget, and I'm saying that they are linearly independent.
But yes, I agree. So, for example, if someone were to write down a spin 10 model, they would write down a 16, and they would give them, spin degrees of freedom, and then it would be a 16. As far as the counting goes, so I've seen this, I'm asking because it shows up all the time when people write models down, and sometimes people will kind of arbitrarily throw half, and that seems really unnatural. So I was just wondering what your perspective is. Like, do you hang on to this extra copy, or do you just get rid of it when you if you were to write a model down?
Yeah. I think what I have here is so beautiful that I wouldn't want to mess with it. But I mean, I'm definitely not in this talk going to be building any models. I'm having this incredibly narrow focus on this particular group and its representation, and I'm just going to work with that. So I'm not even talking at all about spin degrees of freedom, for example. So it may seem, it's probably a bad idea when you're trying to assemble a puzzle to only use, five of the pieces when there are like 30 pieces lying around. But that's exactly what I'm going to do in this talk, because I think it's interesting to focus on this narrow portion of the whole project of trying to figure out what makes the standard model tick.
I ask actually because this is what something that Mia and I kind of struggled through, and what we ended up doing is we ended up kind of flipping one of the spaces so that it would describe the others. One would be a spin up and the other would be spin down. But anyway, it's I was just curious to see if you had an opinion on what to do with this scenario, because it does show up quite a bit. Thanks.
Yes.
I was just going to say, I mean, it sounded a little bit, I might be misunderstanding the discussion, but it sounds to me a little bit like John is talking about the Hilbert space of particles, whereas Cole, I think you're talking about the fields that the Lagrangian is built from, which become, you know, are promoted to the operators that create those particles on the Hilbert space. And so
that's one thing.
It's a little bit like
he's also talking about spin degrees of freedom, which I'm not talking about right here. So, I mean, of course, spin is incredibly important, and it sort of roughly doubles the size of the vector space you should be looking at if you're looking at this Hilbert space.
I was just going to say, so the one factor of two is just the fact that a single creation operator creates a two-dimensional fermionic Hilbert space. I don't know if that is relevant to the question, Cole, but just to mention.
So can you say that one more time?
Well, like if you have one fermionic creation operator, just a, you know, in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, just a single A and its conjugate A dagger, that's in a sense, you know, A and A dagger are, you according to that counting, I think you were talking about, you would call that one object because they're related by a complex conjugate, but they create a two-dimensional fermion Hilbert space, a sort of up and down state in Hilbert space.
I mean, on this particular lambda of C5, we're going to have five creation operators and five annihilation operators, and they generate this. I mean, starting from the ground state, so to speak, starting from the identity element of this algebra, we can get a 32 two-dimensional space.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yes, thank you.
Yep. Yeah, sure. So one way to think about this Grassmann algebra or exterior algebra lambda C5 is that it has a basis labeled by 5-bit strings. I mean, this is a general way to think about exterior algebras, but here we have the number 5 showing up. And so they're answering 5 yes or no questions, which you can say are, is the particle isospin up? Is it isospin down? So those two are connected to the two here. Notice the 5 is broken into it, 2 and 3. And then three other questions. Is it red, is it green, or is it blue? You have to know what it means when you answer several of these questions, yes. For example, what to say, is the particle isospin up and it's isospin down? Well, we decree that means isospin 0. Just as answering both questions no means isospin 0. And red and blue, for example, well, you just look at your color chart here, means magenta, but magenta is anti-green. So the anti-quarks will have these three anti-colors, and they will arise from answering two of these three questions involving color to be yes. And then if you say red and green and blue, we decree that means colorless. So I didn't write it down here, but you could write down a nice little chart. Well, the problem is it's not so little. You could write a nice big chart listing all the 32 particles and antiparticles in one generation of the standard model, and writing down their bit strings along with them. In the paper with John Huerta, we more or less did that, although we didn't. We presented some charts that let you see how that all works out. So this is all very nice. This means that you don't actually need to understand particle physics to talk about the particles in the standard model, as long as you're willing to believe me and say that the different fermions correspond to 5-bit strings. Okay, so now that's compressing the usual knowledge of the gauge group of the standard model and its representation on the fermions and anti-fermions in one generation into a mathematically tractable package. But we haven't really gotten to the next stage, which is to understand this group and its representation. I mean, why five and not seven? Why break five into 2 plus 3 and not break seven into 3 plus 4 or something like that? I'm not sure how much progress I'll make on answering those questions, but I'll try. And so grand unified theories tend to usually be the way that people express their desire to understand this group. So even if you don't believe that those theories are true, that's the place to look for more information about this question. So for example, SU5 is a subgroup of SO10 in a very natural way, right? SO10 is the rotations of a 10-dimensional real vector space with but if you look at if you treat that 10-dimensional real vector space as a 5-dimensional complex space by giving it a complex structure, and you put on and you look at the unitary transformations with determinant 1, then you get a special subgroup of the rotations, which is SU5. So SU5 is sort of born as a subgroup of SO10, but an interesting thing about it is that because it's a simply connected group, then it actually, you can lift that inclusion into SO10 into an inclusion into spin 10. So this one-to-one, this map from SU5 into spin 10, but then it projects down in a 2-to-1 way on SO10. This confused the heck out of me for a while, because we're saying that this group SU5 is a subgroup both of SO10 and of its double cover. But it's a fact that even though this map is 2-to-1, that if you compose this map with this map, it's just 1-to-1. It's ultimately due to the fact that SU5 is simply connected. So you never get two guys here that both map to the same thing from guys in SU5. So we can think of SU5 as a subgroup of spin 10. And that's nice, because then the sort of obvious representation of SU5 on lambda of C5 extends to a representation of the larger group spin 10 on lambda of C5. And this is called the Dirac spinner representation. And what's nice about that is that now, now this is an irreducible representation. Let's see, am I saying that right? Yeah. So anyway, we're able to think of all the fermions and anti-fermions as elements of lambda of C5. I guess I'm getting that a bit wrong. It breaks up into two parts, the left-handed and right-handed vial spinner representations. There are two 16-dimensional irreducible representations of spin 10, which when you sum them together, give you this Dirac spinner representation. So here's what's going on. I've showed you how S of U2 times U3, the true gauge group of the standard model, is contained in SU5. And then I've sketched out how that's contained in spin 10. But it turns out that there's another very important subgroup of spin 10, which is what you get when you break the 10 into 4 and 6. You might think that spin 4 times spin 6 was a subgroup of spin 10. But because of the way double covers work, you'd be sort of double counting. And so it's really spin 4 times spin 6 mod Z mod 2, which is a subgroup of spin 10. So that works out in general. Whenever you take a spin group and sort of break it into two parts, that is by taking this number 10, say whatever it is, and writing it as a sum of two numbers, you get this type of phenomenon with this, including the Z mod 2 here. Anyway, the interesting thing is that the true gauge group of the standard model is exactly the intersection of SU5 and this other group, spin 4 times spin 6 over Z mod 2 inside spin 10. And so that other group, except for this subtlety of the Z mod 2, is another famous group among people who work on grand unified theories. So SU5 is a famous group used for grand unification. So is spin 10, but so is spin 4 times spin 6. That's called the gauge group of the Padi Salam model. And there, people typically take advantage of some isomorphisms between groups to say spin 4 is isomorphic to SU2 times SU2, and spin 6 is isomorphic to SU4. So when you normally read about the Padi Salam model, they say SU2 times SU2 times SU4 is the gauge group of the Padi Salam model. But that's very nice, but that does contain a subgroup, that product, that acts trivially on all known particles. And that's the physical aspect of this mathematical fact that you need to mod out by Z mod 2 to get spin 4 times spin 6 to be a subgroup of spin 10.
John, yeah. I see there's a question. Tejinder?
Yeah, I'm not able to easily catch the question, so it's great if you...
Hi. My question was that so the standard model is in the intersection of SU5 and the other group. What's left outside of it?
By the way, it's not just in it, it's exactly equal to it, which is the exciting part. Yeah.
Also, nothing is left out.
No, this group is exactly the intersection of these two groups.
I agree. It is the intersection. So there must be something left, residuals, which are not in the intersection, no?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's lots of stuff in T5 that's not in this, and there's lots of stuff here that's not in that. Mm-hmm.
That's not easy to characterize, is it? What is left out?
It's pretty easy to characterize it, but it's always easier to characterize what's in something than what's not.
Yeah, so what has worried me is, are we leaving out something important in the outsides by just focusing on the intersection? What is the rest of it?
If you believe in the spin 10 grand unified theory, then you're leaving out lots of stuff when you go to this intersection. You should, if you believe in the spin 10 theory, you should keep everything in there. If you believe in the SU5 grand unified theory, and there have been people who have, then you should not leave out anything out of that. If you believe in the Padi Salam model, you should not leave out anything of that. But my philosophy for this talk, only for the purposes of this talk, is that I'm interested in the standard model and the true gauge group of the standard model. So that's my primary focus of interest. I'm not making a physics claim that that's the correct group. I'm just saying that's the group I'm thinking about. And so for me, these other groups are just serving as scaffolding for understanding that group. And so I'm heading in the direction of saying, maybe this way of thinking about the standard model gauge group can shed some more light on its nature. Yeah, so we're leaving things out, but
yeah, thank you.
That's not my concern right now. So the point is that we can think of the standard model as sort of the, metaphorically, the intersection of Yorgi Glashow, the SU5, and the Padi Salam. And so here we get to back to the theme I was talking about, which is that mathematicians like to understand a group as the group of symmetries of some object, some structure. And so you could ask the following, what does SU5 preserve? What structure does it preserve? So I've said it's a subgroup of spin 10, and so it acts on R to the 10, for example, but what does it preserve? Well, it preserves, first of all, a complex structure that is a linear map from R10 to itself that squares to -1. And when you put a complex structure on a real vector space, it lets you treat it as a complex vector space. So loosely speaking, this complex structure lets you think of R10 as C to the 5. But then it also, because of the S in SU5, it consists of transformations, which when you think of them as complex matrices, have determinant one. And so what that means is that they're preserving a complex volume form that is an element of lambda 5, c to the 5, the top exterior power, thought of as a complex vector space that's not zero. So we're much more used to thinking about real volume forms. The actual measurement of volume in three-dimensional space, for example, involves an element of lambda 3 of r to the 3. Complex volume, a little bit more elusive in their meaning, but that's what's being preserved by the when you say you've got that S in the SU5. I'll say a bit more about them later. Similarly, this Pati Salam group is the subgroup of spin 10 that preserves a 4+6 splitting of R10 into a four-dimensional space and a six-dimensional space. So the standard model gauge group is going to be preserving all that stuff. So the true gauge group of the standard model, we can say, is the subgroup of spin 10 that preserves a complex structure on R10, first of all, then a complex volume form, which is something you can only define after you have the complex structure, and then also a compatible 4+6 splitting, by which I mean a splitting of our R10 into a four-dimensional space and a six-dimensional space, which are actually complex subspaces of R10, which we have made into a complex vector space. So loosely speaking, one that gives you a splitting of C5 into C2+C3. So for some reason, nature has opted to make the gauge group of our theory of particle physics be the symmetries of a 10-dimensional real vector space that preserve this particular structure. And it's our job to figure out why, if we want to try to understand the standard model, or else to discard this as like a red herring. And when I say symmetries of a 10-dimensional vector space, I'm really talking about spin 10. So there's a double cover here too, which of course we need to get the spinner representation to make sense.
John, sorry, can I interrupt and make a comment?
Sure.
I don't know if it's you're going to mention it, but there is another way to think about SU5 appearing. It turns out that SU5 is a stabilizer of a spinner in, so if you take a generic spinner in a 16-dimensional representation of spin 10, it turns out that its stabilizer is precisely SU5.
I'm thinking about whether I know that somewhere deep in the recesses of my brain. That's right. Yeah. So I'm going to talk a bit about Calabi-Yau manifolds in the next slide. And
maybe another comment is that in the grand in the spin 10 literature, it's very well understood that to go down to the standard model gauge group from spin 10, you need two structures. Well, or they talk about two different Higgs fields, but basically Higgs field. You take a Higgs field, you introduce some wave for it. So basically you're introducing some structure. And the two Higgs fields that you need to get down to standard model gauge group is spin oil representation of spin 10, which is that spinner that I'm talking about. It breaks you down to SU5. Uh-huh. And then another structure that you need is, well, that can vary, but one of the possibilities most often considered is Higgs in the adjoint representation. So that can break you down to Pati Salam gauge group. And it's known that the intersection is precisely the standard model gauge group.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, this gives you a link to the standard spin 10 grand unified literature.
Yeah, thanks very much. That's very helpful. Yes, I'm partially out of ignorance, but also partially out of taste. I'm wanting to sort of sidestep the discussion where all symmetry breaking is done via Higgs bosons, because I just have some sense that physicists have gotten a little carried away with starting with a huge group and then breaking it down to a small group by assuming lots of Higgs bosons. But that's
Higgs is just Higgs in a valve is just some structure.
Right. That's right.
But then when you try to preserve it.
Right. That's
right. Exactly what you're doing. You can say that your complex structure is also a Higgs field because it's just some structure. And what commutes exactly. with it.
I was wanting to say that someone else's Higgs field is a structure, really a structure. I mean, when you call it a Higgs field and then you put it a Higgs term into the Lagrangian, then you're making more assumptions, not just about what structure.
That's true.
Yeah. At the minimum,
there's kinematics to the Higgs. Kinematically, Higgs is just some object that you require to preserve. And then there is also dynamics.
Yeah, that's right. I'm hoping that some smart people invent many more mechanisms other than the usual Higgs dynamics to break these symmetries down. Uh-huh. So we can dramatize what I had said on the previous slide in the following way. I'm not claiming that any profound physical significance for this, but it's just nice to think about. So if you have a Riemannian manifold where every tangent space is equipped with a complex structure in a way that's preserved by parallel transport, that's called a Kähler manifold. And mathematicians love those. They're sort of the complex version of Riemannian manifolds. But then a Kähler manifold where every tangent space also has a volume form, a complex volume form, I should say, preserved by parallel transport, that's what's called a Calabi-Yau manifold. So these structures that we're throwing on our 10-dimensional vector space are, when you think about them globally in terms of manifolds, they are structures that are turning a Riemannian manifold into a manifold with extra structure. So you can make the following statement, and which is true. If you take any 10-dimensional manifold that's a product of a 4D and 6D Calabi-Yau manifolds, so you'll notice what I've done there. I've taken a 10-dimensional manifold and I've given it the structure. I've given a way to split its tangent space into a 4-dimensional part and a 6-dimensional part. And also I've put on this Calabi-Yau structure in a compatible way, which breaks the symmetry group down to from SO10 to SU5, from spin 10 to SU5. So that's just what we were talking about in the previous slide. So anyway, take a 10-dimensional manifold that's a product of 4D and 6D Calabi-Yau manifolds, then M is naturally equipped with a principal bundle where the gauge group is the gauge group of the standard model, and the Dirac spinners on M will transform in a representation of this group, which is exactly what we see as the fermions and antifermions in one generation, including the right-handed neutrino and its antiparticle. So what's amusing about this is that you may have heard physicists, string theorists running around talking about 10-dimensional manifolds and breaking 10 dimensions up into 4 and 6, and the 6-dimensional one being a Calabi-Yau manifold. So some of the math I'm talking about here is very familiar from string theory, but here we're seeing that this math is very strongly connected to the standard model. Now, when I told people about this once upon a time, I wrote a paper that I never bothered publishing about this, which there are links on my slides to the archive. So it's on the archive. When I told people about this, all the string theorists said, well, yeah, but that's no use. There's nothing you can do with that because you can't actually use this to build a string theory that resembles the standard model. Because the way the way the Calabi-Yau manifolds are getting deployed here is not in such a way that you'd get a string theory that gave you the standard model. So I hung my head in shame that my attempt to do something was not very useful, but that's just not useful from the point of view of string theory. Maybe there's some other way to get something out of this, but I don't know what it is. I'm just posing this as an interesting fact. Okay, so anyway, we've seen there's a connection between the standard model and 10-dimensional space, that is 10-dimensional Euclidean space. But it's also connected to 10-dimensional space-time. And here I'll be sketching out some ideas that I learned of from Ivan Todorov and Michel Dubois-Violette's paper, a series of papers actually, but maybe the most relevant one is this one, deducing the symmetry of the standard model from the automorphism and structure groups of the exceptional Jordan algebra. I'll talk about Jordan algebras much more in my second talk, but here I just want to point out that first of all, a very well-known and beautiful fact is that you can think of 4D Minkowski spacetime as the space of 2x2 Hermitian complex matrices. You can write any Hermitian 2x2 matrix in this form here. And what's nice is that then the determinant of that matrix looks just like the Minkowski metric. Notice Y being complex really has two components. And so this is the usual Minkowski metric on 4D Minkowski spacetime. This fact is used throughout physics, but it works for other division algebras as well. And in particular, 10D Minkowski spacetime, as a bunch of you have already discussed, can be seen as the space of 2x2 Hermitian octonionic matrices with its Minkowski metric. So the math works just the same way. And then we can do the following trick. We can pick arbitrarily any unit imaginary octonion, or in other words, any octonion that squares to negative one. That's another way to say the same thing. And then that gives an inclusion of the complex numbers in the octonions, where the I of the complex numbers is mapped to this particular octonion that I'm calling I as well. And so that does a lot of things for you. One thing it does for you that's obvious is that it takes the octonions, which is an eight-dimensional real vector space, and splits it up into this subspace, which we're identifying with the complex numbers, and then its orthogonal complement. There's an inner product on the octonion, so you can take the orthogonal complement, and that'll have six real dimensions. But, yes?
Oh, is now a good time to mention Tijinder has a question, I see.
Yeah, okay. Sorry to interrupt you. So what happens with the quaternions if I used quaternions?
Then you get a six-dimensional Minkowski spacetime.
Anything interesting about it? I mean, I'm just curious. Has someone put? I'm very interested in that object. And
there must be some. Well, John Huerta and I have a paper which I'm mentioning just because we have to be the ones that write it, but various people have noticed that you can formulate super string theories in dimensions 3, 4, 6, and 10 using this same trick here, which works for the reals, the complexes, the quaternions, and the octonions. Mm. So there's a lot of, and I shouldn't be pointing to our paper because there are other people in the audience who have written papers about the same general theme. So there's a lot you can do in all of those cases.
In particular, I was curious because it will also come at the end of your slides. Can one set something like a gravity weak unification in six dimensions?
I want to focus on my talk. Six-dimensional gravity weak theories now.
Please go ahead. Please.
Yeah, we can discuss all sorts of theories at the end, I think, but I'm getting nervous about my time here.
So,
I'm not mainly interested in splitting eight dimensions up into 2+6 here, although that's inevitably what you get when you pick a unit imaginary octonion. What I'm bringing this up for is that when you include the complex numbers in the octonions by picking a unit imaginary octonion, then that also includes the 2x2 Hermitian complex matrices into the 2x2 Hermitian octonionic matrices. And so that gives an inclusion of 4D spacetime, Minkowski spacetime, into 10D Minkowski spacetime. And then you take the orthogonal complement, and that will be a six-dimensional space with a Euclidean metric on it. So you see, I'd been mentioning how the splitting of 10 into 4+6 is a crucial aspect of the standard model gauge group. And here we're seeing that kind of splitting show up from octonionic, from an octonionic construction. But with a big difference that here I'm talking about 10-dimensional Minkowski spacetime, whereas earlier when I was talking about SO10, I was talking about 10-dimensional Euclidean spacetime. So there's a different signature involved now. So it turns out, and I'll say more about this next time, which is really just an explication of work by Todorov and Dubois-Violette, that the subgroup of spin 9-1, so now we're working in a Lorentzian world here, the subgroup of spin 9-1 that preserves this splitting of 10D spacetime into 4D spacetime and 6D space actually contains a copy of the true gauge group of the standard model. So what we're seeing is that the true gauge group of the standard model is again preserving a 4+6 splitting in this context here, but there's a big difference that now this is a splitting of 10D Minkowski spacetime into 4D Minkowski spacetime and 6D Euclidean space. Whereas in my earlier reflections on the Patti-Salah model, it was a 4+6 splitting of a Euclidean space. So for a while, I was very confused about this. So the puzzle is, right, in this Octonionic approach, we're seeing, and I haven't said how we're seeing it, but take my word for it, we're seeing the standard model gauge group is a subgroup of spin 9-1, whereas in the grand unified approach, it's seen as a subgroup of spin 10. So how can we reconcile these facts? Well, Kirill Krasnov wrote a nice paper about the answer to that question. So the point is that the standard model gauge group actually sits inside spin 9, which is the intersection of spin 9-1 and spin 10. And so part of the point is that the Jordan algebra of 2x2 octonionic Hermitian matrices, it naturally has the structure of a 10D Euclidean space as well as a 10D Minkowski spacetime. I wrote down the Minkowski metric in terms of these matrices, but next time I'll show you we can write down the Euclidean inner product in terms of these matrices as well. And so the symmetries of H2O, the automorphisms of this Jordan algebra, are going to be preserving both the Euclidean metric and the Minkowski metric. And so if we go to the double cover of that symmetry group, it's spin 9, which is the intersection of the spin 9-1 and the spin 10. So that's a rather long-winded way to talk about things, but which nonetheless I think is interesting. But Kirill gave a more terse approach where he just directly explains how the standard model gauge groups is a subgroup of spin 9. And there are different ways to see that, and I'll just whiz you through one of them. So let's see why the standard model gauge group is contained in spin 9. So the idea is you can start with the Patti-Salah model, and I didn't really write down concretely what the embedding of the standard model gauge group into this Patti-Salah group was, but now I'm doing it. So I'm just sort of pulling it out of thin air here. So we have the usual SU2 is mapped into the left of the two SU2s in the Patti-Salah model, whereas the right SU2 in the Patti-Salah model depends only on the phase in the U1. So this is the one that acts on the right-handed particles in the standard model fermions. We also pack the SU3 and the U1 into SU4 in this way, which is again a way that's cleverly chosen so that we get the matrix of determinant 1. Now this map here you can see is 3-1, basically because if you take alpha to be a cube root of unity, you can get this to be the identity. And then if you pick H to be a cube root, the inverse of that cube root of unity times the identity, then you can make this be the identity as well. So it's this map here is a 3-1 map. And then what you can do is you can just throw out the right-handed SU2. So what I'm doing here is I'm taking this formula here and I'm just throwing out this middle term here. So we get this map into just SU2 times SU4. And this map is just as good in the sense that it's still 3-1. It's not massive. It doesn't have a huge kernel. And so we can actually just work with that. But then SU2 is isomorphic to spin 3, and SU4 is isomorphic to spin 6. So that map is a way to map U1 times SU2 times SU3 into spin 3 times spin 6. That's another way to think about it. But then you can go further because you can map spin 3 and time spin 6 in spin 9. So here what we're doing, you see, is we're chopping 9-dimensional Euclidean space into a 3-dimensional part and a 6-dimensional part and a product of two spaces. And we get this map here. And as I mentioned before, this map is 2-1. It's not an inclusion, it's 2-1. So we get a map from U1 times SU2 times SU3 into spin 9. And the composite map is 6-1. This part here is 3-1. This part is 2-1. So it's at least plausible that this composite should be 6-1. And it is. And its kernel is exactly the Z mod 6 that we love, the one that acts trivially on all known particles. So what that means is that we get a 1-1 map from the standard model gauge group where we've modded out by that Z mod 6 into spin 9. And that group there is the true gauge group of the standard model. So in other words, we get a 1-1 map from S of U2 times U3 into spin 9. So you can pack it into spin 9. You don't need all of spin 10 to fit the true gauge group of the standard model in it. And so that resolves the apparent paradox that some people are embedding this group into spin 10 and others are embedding it into spin 9-1. Well, in fact, it's getting embedded in the intersection of those two. So that's the math that I wanted, that's the body of what I wanted to present. So let me just summarize what I was saying and maybe offer a few very tame speculations, not very bold speculations. So the big point I was trying to make here is that the true gauge group of the standard model is precisely the subgroup of spin 10 that preserves a complex structure on 10-dimensional Euclidean space, a complex volume form, and a compatible 4+6 splitting. Compatible meaning that the 4- and 6-dimensional real vector spaces are actually complex spaces with respect to this complex structure. So if there's anything to any of this stuff, further understanding of the standard model should involve some better understanding of this structure here. What's nice about this structure? I'll talk about that more next time, but there you can imagine going in different directions with this. But we've also seen that the true gauge group of the standard model is a subgroup of spin 9-1 that preserves a 4+6 splitting of 10D Minkowski spacetime and some other structure. I didn't say what the extra structure was in this Minkowskian case. I said that the standard model gauge group is included in spin 9-1, but I didn't say what extra structure it picks out. I'll talk about that next time using the Octonians. And it turns out that not one nice answer to that question actually brings the exceptional Jordan algebra H3O into the story. So that's 3x3 Hermitian Octonionic matrices. This is basically summarizing work of Dubois, Violette, and Todorov, but maybe giving it a little extra polish on top. So we have these two stories. You could reconcile / unify these two accounts by complexifying. If you complexify, the signature gets washed out and then there's no difference between these two stories anymore. That is, if you work instead of R10 to begin with, if you work with C10, then that's one way to reconcile these two stories. So it's an open question as to my mind whether that's something that we want to do. one thing I want to emphasize is that the 10-dimensional Minkowski space-time or Euclidean space that I'm talking about can't be physical space-time. That is, it can't contain the 4D Minkowski space-time that we normally talk about, and ditto for the Euclidean version, because the SU2 that I'm talking about here is sitting inside the standard model gauge group, is acting on isospin, not spin. So in other words, if you pack the standard model gauge group into spin 9-1, you don't, as far as I know, you don't have room for a commuting copy of spin 3-1, which we would want to use as the Lorentz group in physical space-time. So there's something funny going on here about this 10-dimensional Minkowski space-time, that it has some other significance, if any. But there's also some eerie link between the left and right SU2s in the Patti-Salam group, each of which are acting on elementary particles in an internal way, and the left and right-handed SU2s, which are sitting there in the Euclidean version of physical space-time. So those are acting as basically rotations of four-dimensional Euclidean space. And the reason why I say that there's this eerie link is because we know that the left SU2 in the Patti-Salam group is acting on the particles that are have left-handed spin, and the right-handed SU2 is acting on the ones that have right-handed spin. So there's something going on here, which various people have noted, that somehow the weak force seems to be more closely connected to 4D space-time than the other forces. In other words, it somehow it seems to about the Lorentz group by virtue of the fact that it grossly violates parity, the left and right-handed particles transform differently with respect to the weak force group as well. And so this discussion of gravi-weak theories arises out of trying to get somewhere with this idea. I think that's the end of my speculations, very timid speculations in the sense that I'm just raising some issues, not proposing any theory. But I hope that this presentation makes you all run out and develop new theories. Thanks.
All right, thank you for that great talk. And are there any further questions?
I have a question that occurred to me during your talk. There is a characterization that you described that the true gauge group of a standard model is intersection in spin 10 of two groups, right? It's SU5 and Patti-Salam.
Uh-huh.
So do you think there is a possible analogous characterization of standard model gauge group sitting inside spin 9 as intersection of two different groups?
There has to be. The question is just how beautiful can you make it be that?
But it can be SU5, right? Because SU5, I don't think it fits into spin 9, so it's something else. So I'm just curious what happens to that statement of intersection of two groups at the spin 9 level.
I haven't really tried to answer that. In my next talk, I'll answer how do you pick out the standard model gauge group inside spin 9-1. So somehow if you combine this talk and the other talk, then you should be able to figure out how it sits inside spin 9, right? Because I can tell you how it sits inside spin 10, I can tell you how it sits inside spin 9-1, when their intersection of those is spin 9. So in theory, the answer is sort of buried in all the things I'm gonna say, but that's different than actually like giving a clear answer to your question. So I haven't answered that, and I think that's a really good thing to think about. You could probably figure it out in a day because you're the expert on spin 9. So I see a question from
Biswajit.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask one trivial question. You said that when the decomposition 4 plus 6 takes place here, you do not identify six-dimensional space as some sort of extra dimension, something what happens in string theory. So here, is, I suppose you don't need those extra six dimensions to be compact manifold or something like that, is it?
No, here, I mean, I'm not formulating any Lagrangians in this talk, but no, here, in its simplest form, this 10-dimensional space is some Euclidean vector space, not compactified or anything. I mean, the meaning of this 10-dimensional space becomes much clearer when you put on the complex structure and think of it as C to the 5, and then it's just a 5-dimensional space whose different directions we call up, down, red, green, and blue. So it's a space of those different qualities that a particle can have.
Thanks.
Sure.
All right. Well, are there further questions that I'm missing? If not, that was a
there
terrific
one,
talk.
One,
oh, there is one. Oh, Tejinder, yes, go ahead.
Yes, sorry. Thanks, that was a beautiful talk. I actually just had a small comment from the earlier part of your talk, where you mentioned that it is really hopeless to try to understand where the fine structure constant comes from. So I think it's not that bad. I've recently showed that from the exceptional Jordan algebra H3O coupled to a matrix valued Lagrangian dynamics, one can actually show that you get the number out. Essentially, what is happening is there are no free coupling constants in the Lagrangian. They must get their values determined. The dimensionless coupling constant must get their values determined from the characteristic equation of the H3O. So I just wanted to say it'd be great if you could have a look at the paper.
Yeah, you sent me that paper maybe 2 days ago.
Yeah.
So yeah, I wasn't really trying to say that the figuring out the value of the fine structure constant was hopeless. I was saying that it's traditionally come to be regarded as hopeless. I mean,
I agree. So my submission to that is that
historical statement that is a prediction. So it's very dangerous to think of anything as being hopeless, but some things people have knocked their heads on for longer.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So what I wanted to just add to that was I think the problems of string theory arise because we want to use quantum field theory rules at the Planck scale, and that makes it very difficult to get a unique compactification. We do not even understand what causes the compactification. But if you do a rethink there on what is my physics, the QFT is to be replaced by something else, and then along with the, you know, the octonions and division algebras, one seems to do quite well. So in my opinion, the right place for the exceptional Jordan algebra is along with a Lagrangian dynamic. So it troubles me that our community doesn't look at the Lagrangian. We are only looking at the representations which will get us this kind of model. But we think that the Lagrangian will be the same as before. But I've troubled with that. The Lagrangian has to be rewritten in such a way that it respects the symmetries of the division algebras. They're just my view.
So the only reason why I wasn't bringing in any Lagrangians here is because I had enough material for an hour-long talk without them, and because I think focusing on these simple, purely algebraic facts so we provide people with some raw material for developing theories of different sorts. So frustrated with the state of particle physics that I'm wanting to, at least in my talks, remain rather agnostic about whether we're using quantum field theory or string theory or spin foams or some other kind of way of describing dynamics, and just saying that if whatever you do, if your theory gives you the standard model, it more or less has to be giving you this sort of algebra that I'm talking about.
That I agree with you. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
All right. Very good.
Great.
Now, do we have any further questions?
I should expect people to start telling me new theories of physics. Now, no more questions. I want answers.
Right. Okay. Well, with that instruction from,
figure one out.
Yeah. Okay. Well, with that exhortation, let's pause it till next week. Thank you very much again for your talk, John.
Thank you.